Members, today's Wednesday, March 12th, and the time is 1:01. So I call this meeting of Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We have a very full agenda, folks, and I am going to ask testifiers to keep their to 2 minutes. And we have Mrs. Scorby, and she will chase you down if you go past 2 minutes, right? No, she wouldn't hurt a fly. Anyways, we ask you guys to keep it to 2 minutes. So, Representative Perryman, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you like to move the approval of those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've reviewed the minutes, and I so move to approve them.
Thank you, Representative Perryman. She moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, our first, okay, just give a lay of the land here. So we have Representative Torkelson on first at House File 1029. So we can stay on schedule. That will be no more than 15 minutes. House File 1912, our goal is 15 minutes. House File 1105, our goal is 10 minutes. Then House File 1100, 20 minutes. And then approximately 35 minutes for House File 2057. And with caucus tonight, of course, we want to get done during this meeting. So with that, Representative, first on the agenda is House File 1029 from Representative Torkelson. The chair moves House File 1029 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over or possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, Representative Torkelson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Backer, for hearing this bill today, and it's a very important bill. Other testifiers will explain some of the details, but I just want to make sure that folks understand that this in no way is meant to disrespect the work that is done in this area as far as approving these various diseases to be on the screening panel. I know that work is being done behind the scenes and hopefully will lead to the right conclusion, and perhaps this bill will not be necessary at all by the time we end this year's session. But in the meantime, there are some people that care very much about this disease and other diseases, rare diseases, and this is a chance for them to share their voice with the legislature and just highlight how important this work is. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to turn it over to testifiers.
Go ahead. It's Ms. Barnes, and 2 minutes, please. Thank you for, please state your name and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Backer and the committee. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm testifying on my own behalf personally, and I'm not speaking for the Rare Disease Advisory Council, and I'm going to testify in support of Bill 1029. My daughter Chloe was born in 2008, an apparently healthy child. She grew into a spunky, beautiful, curly-headed toddler with a life of breathless wonder ahead of her. Around 18 months of age, I started to notice subtle but ominous signs that Chloe's development was far from normal. She seemed to struggle with basic tasks involving her motor skills. I remember telling her pediatrician, "It's almost like her body won't do what her brain wants it to." After numerous frustrating visits in which I was assured she's just taking her time and let's wait and see, I finally took her to a pediatrician who ordered an MRI. After more specialty visits, she was eventually diagnosed, and we heard the two most horrific words in our family's lexicon, metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD. MLD is an aggressive neurodegenerative disease that robs children of all of their function before the age of 5. As was the case with Chloe, these children first lose their ability to walk and move, then the ability to swallow and breathe. Many of the children develop dementia and become cortically blind. The one grace we received from the medical team in Chloe's case was that Chloe's hearing was likely preserved, and I knew this was true because her vitals would stabilize when I would sing to her. Chloe passed away in 2010 at a time when there was no effective treatment and no cure for MLD. But fast forward to today, the pace of science for leukodystrophies has been truly breathtaking, and we now have an effective treatment for MLD. No child should ever suffer the way Chloe did. No family should ever be put through months and months of seeking a diagnosis only to be told that it is too late because the disease has progressed too far. Through the amazing dedication and sacrifice of researchers, many of them right here in Minnesota, families, and our public health workers, we now have both the technology to diagnose and the treatments for these children. both for the older siblings and for the younger siblings. Please pass this bill and add MLD to the newborn screening panel. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Then we have on Zoom Jennifer Barnes, spelled different. So thank you. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, hi, my name is Jennifer Braun. I'm a nurse practitioner at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also the clinical director for our clinical trial program, as well working with pediatric blood and marrow transplants. I've been working there for about 10 years, during the majority of which time I've been working with patients who have inherited metabolic disorders, such as metachromatic leukodystrophy. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all today. As I can tell you, we typically have not received very many referrals to our blood and marrow transplant program, knowing that oftentimes right now, the only way that we're finding out about patient cases are once patients are either symptomatic or in another devastating situation when we're having an older sibling who's symptomatic, diagnosed with metachromatic leukodystrophy, and then we happen to pick up a younger child who is perhaps not symptomatic and able to undergo therapy options. As Erica mentioned, metachromatic leukodystrophy is an entirely devastating disease, and I think one of the most challenging parts about it is that once patients become symptomatic, there's typically nothing that we can do for them. And their prognosis, as Erica described, is quite devastating for both the patient and their family from a disability and quality of life outcome perspective. We do occasionally have patients that we have received diagnosis where they're relatively early with symptoms, but I think it's really important to emphasize that even with those patient scenarios, any disease progression that's occurred up to that point is irreversible. And so oftentimes, even with those patients who are diagnosed when symptoms are relatively early, they end up dealing with chronic disability and long-term deficits that we can never overcome. In recent years, as Erica mentioned, we've been able to introduce additional treatment outcomes for metachromatic leukodystrophy, and we've had several other referrals to our program, patients who are pre-symptomatic and able to benefit from cellular therapy treatments. One of those first patients I saw with Dr. Orchard at our center in 2020. There's a great documentary out there here from the state of Minnesota that's called Sequencing Hope. And it's a great example of what we can do with treatment options when we're able to catch patients before they're showing symptoms of the disease. For many other referrals that have come to our site, we've unfortunately had patients who are too progressed, as I mentioned earlier, to offer any therapy. And the one thing that our whole team continues to say to both families and amongst ourselves is that we need newborn screening. We need an ability to identify these patients before they develop symptoms so that we can treat them early and allow them the opportunities to have fulfilling lives and great quality of life that hopefully will also decrease overall costs to the healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none, members, I will open up to questions for about 5 minutes. So, Representative Bonner. Yep, I'm sorry. Representative Bierman, that was a
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you, Rep. Torkelson, for bringing the bill forward. And thank you also for Ms. Barnes for talking about your life experience here, and just appreciate the work you've been doing on rare diseases in the past years. I'm hopeful that this will get on this federal list, and I just wondered if you know or if we should talk to DHS about whether it's stated that this list is recommended. The RESP list is recommended for states, but I wonder if Minnesota follows that closely. If you may know, or we can call someone up.
Representative Torkelson, or?
Well, actually, I think I can answer a question. It's not my area of expertise, but my understanding is that Minnesota does keep up with the federal list, and on occasion can go beyond that, where we would actually put something on our list that is not yet put on the federal list. And this, I think, is an example of that. It came close to making our list recently, and they are reexamining their decision at their next meeting, and we believe there's a good chance it could make the list, Minnesota's list, after the next round of hearings.
Very good. Mr. Chair, just thank you, Representative Torkelson, for bringing that forward and doing the advocacy work. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have this time Representative Bonner, and then we have one more rep, and then we will go to the next bill, please. So go ahead, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for this bill. And of course, thank you for the continued work on rare diseases. I know we've had a number of conversations about this, and ironically, my question was very similar to the line that Lead Behrman just brought forward. So I will just make a brief comment and say I really appreciate the continued effort on this particular issue. Often you will hear me say, talk about an ounce of prevention. And I think that this is a really good bill that has the ability to have a significant impact for families. So I certainly wish it well, and I hope that we can get it on the list.
Thank you. And then finally, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to, and thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Torkelson. I'm so sorry about both of these tragedies that happened in your families. And I just wanted to kind of give a shout out to the newborn screening program generally, because this is just a fantastic example of something that we do as a state that has these amazing impacts on the lives of so many people. And it's been controversial in the past, and that's why I want to bring this up, because it does involve using people's data, retaining some data and so on, and that has made it a target at times, because there are many people in our legislature and in the world who are really concerned, rightly, about data privacy. But there's an important balance to be had when you're talking about data privacy, and you know, when is it worth, some maintaining data, government holding on to data for really important purposes? And I think the newborn screening program is just an excellent example of that. And I'm glad that this now enjoys bipartisan support, and I hope that it always will be so, because this is just an example of how science is continuing to make it possible to prevent horrible outcomes for people and improve people's lives. And it, you know, these kinds of things, they don't care. This doesn't care what party you are, what your family's background is, any of that. This is something that, you know, science and coupled with really good government program can really do for folks. And I just thank you for your support of this, Representative Torkelson, and I just hope that all members can be strong supporters of the newborn screening program.
Final words, Representative
Torkelson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for hearing this bill. I just want to remind people that Minnesota is on the cutting edge both of genetic testing and genetic therapy, and we should continue to lead, and this bill pushes us in that direction.
Yes. And we thank you. Thank you, Representative Torkelson, and testifiers. We know this is not easy, but we want to move this forward and help others. So the chair lays over House File 1029 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So next next will be House File 1912, Representative Scrobber. The chair moves that House File 1912 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill. Representative Scrobber, welcome to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready, and our goal is 15 minutes for this bill.
I'll be quicker than that, Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer and committee. My name is Roger Scrobber. I represent District 3A. The testifier is drove down from Grand Marais, 5-hour drive, to give testimony to you folks. So this is to help a small rural healthcare facility provide senior services. North Shore Health is, you know what, I'm going to skip that part. I'm going to let Kimber talk about it. Grand Marais is a small town on the North Shore. It's the county is 5,600 people. 8% property is private. 92% is public. It's pretty hard to raise taxes and to raise the funds to make this work like a big city can. So any help that we can help these that community up there. But I'm going to let Kimber tell her story about what's going on in Grand Marais. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Backer and committee members. I'm Kimber Ralstead, and I'm the CEO Administrator of North Shore Health in Grand Marais. And I'm here to express my support for House File 1912. Some of you may remember me from the legislation North Shore Health worked on in 2022. And I'm here today to finish that process. And I'd like to give a little context for this legislation. For at least the last 20 years, the nursing home that is a part of North Shore Health has lost an average of $1.5 million a year, with this year's loss being over $2 million. The ability of North Shore Health to maintain these losses is not sustainable, even with an almost $1.9 million tax levy. As you all know, nursing home reimbursement does not allow any nursing home to simply increase our charges to cover our expenses. As a hospital-attached nursing home, we are also subject to the Medicare hospital cost report rules and have to allocate expenses based upon those requirements. This usually results in moving expenses from the hospital cost center that are reimbursed at 101% of allowed costs to the nursing home, where our costs exceed the limits established by the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the legislature. For example, in 2025, our nursing home other operating costs exceed the operating per diem limit by $74 per resident day. These reimbursement rules have us moving expenses from one area where we could get some payment to an area where we are over the limits and don't get paid at all. And this is why I'm here today. North Shore Health is asking for a legislative change that would provide our organization with an opportunity to obtain at least $800,000, perhaps more in funding. We are asking that we not be subject to the swing bed length of stay limitations and for the ability to have Medicaid provide reimbursement for swing bed care in the hospital level for our nursing home type residents. Our intention is to reclassify one half of our nursing home and call it hospital. The only thing that will change for our residents is the name of the location of their room. It will be hospital versus nursing home, and how their stay is reimbursed. Those currently covered by Medicaid would be reimbursed at the $299 state swing bed rate per day, rather than the nursing home case mix rate. And just FYI, our lowest rate currently is $366.27 per day. There will be no cost to the state of Minnesota. And I repeat, there will be no cost to the state of Minnesota. By changing the areas of costs between the hospital and the nursing home differently on paper, it changes how North Shore Health allocates our costs, thus increasing reimbursement from Medicare. This is a very specific legislative change that would only affect North Shore Health. We have interacted with the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services for years about this concept. Due to financial losses, it has been periodically suggested that the nursing home be closed. It hurts my heart to even think about that option because North Shore Health is the only skilled nursing home in Cook County, and there is no assisted living available. The members of our community who need this level of care would have to leave our community, and their family members and friends would have to travel possibly 2 hours or more to see them. I want to give an example. I have a resident. She passed away last month. She is 100 years old. She lived in Grand Portage before coming to our nursing home. She was a member of the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa. She had no family. She was a dearly beloved member of the community. She had visitors that came multiple times a week to see her. Had she have been further away, she would not have had the support of her community members that she so enjoyed and in her 100 years. And she missed being 101 by a week.
Okay. If, wrap North it Shore up, please.
Health, North Shore Health's goal is to remain viable, to provide the services to our community, such as the nursing home, home care, the hospital with the emergency room, and we're also the ambulance service. Please help us do this. I'm asking for your support of House File 1912. Thank you, Chair Backer and committee members, for your consideration.
Thank you, thank you. Would anyone from the public like to testify? Okay, seeing none. Members, I will open up to questions and discussion. We will go up to 1:30 on this bill. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Becker. Thank you for the testimony. I was just wondering, just wanted to confirm there were 16 hospital beds and 37 nursing, skilled nursing beds. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Chair Becker and Representative Bierman, yes. We have 37 licensed nursing home beds and 16-bed critical access hospital.
And Chair Becker,
Representative Bierman.
So I just wanted to understand, because I'm not certain that we as a legislature could pass this without getting CMS involved and DHS to do some sort of a waiver on this. And I was wondering if DHS is in the room and maybe could come speak to it.
Is there anybody from DHS that could speak for this or on behalf? Or just to answer Representative Bierman's question.
And
please state your name, and did you need that question re-asked? I'm Director Bailey.
Chair Becker, members of the committee, Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. Yes, please restate the question. I'm also joined, it's a team effort up here. I'm also joined with our Director of Nursing Facilities.
Sure, and Chair Becker, thank you. Just the question is, with what we heard in testimony here, we're dealing with a critical access hospital in a remote area. Other hospitals and nursing facilities are miles and miles away, so it's pretty isolated. And I guess we have to take a team approach on this to figure out what we can do to keep this hospital open and service the people up there in a way that's equitable and functional and keep the facilities open. And I just wanted to understand a little bit more detail of what that would entail. It's not just us doing a bill. I mean, there would be some sort of needs from CMS on this, it sounds like.
I represent Bailey. Or whoever wants to take that question.
Chair Becker, Representative, my understanding is that we would need to work a little bit more with the author on defining a strategy forward on this. We haven't ever done something like this where we have to determine a rate methodology in one aspect of the hospital or nursing home and what rates we're paying in the nursing home aspect of the facility. And so this is a unique kind of idea that we need to work kind of further with the author and the advocates to come to a solution, and it would require federal approval. And I believe there's a meeting on the books, but just not in time for this hearing. Yeah. So,
yeah, I would encourage that DHS work with the author and the facility on the nitty-gritty and figuring that out.
Chair Beck.
Yeah.
If I could. We have actually had meetings with CMS, including the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health. They referred this back to us. This is a concept that is being done in many other states, including North Dakota, Hawaii, Kansas, Montana. So this is not a new and unique concept and not an issue that CMS has concerns about.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Becker. Just wanted to kind of and hear that from everybody in testimony so that we can move forward on it and find a solution to address this special need up there. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I would, again, encourage DHS to significantly work on this and help these residents. So we have one last question. Representative Liebling, you have the final questions for this bill before
you,
we move on.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass. Representative Bierman kind of got to what I was thinking about.
Okay.
I do have one problem, Chair, if I can help.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair, for your. So I just want to point out the testifier knows me from a previous life, and I really want to say that this hospital is so important to the state. When I was working with the flight service, we would have to go up there, and we couldn't get up there all the time either because that unique place is like you can't get an airplane or a helicopter in there. And so Their skill level has to be held to a higher area, and that pay, you have to pay a lot for clinicians to hold that skill level. So I really, you guys have been always, I don't mean to be say struggling, but you've always pulled through, and I really appreciate you doing that for the state of Minnesota. And literally, you're 2 hours from nowhere, and I don't mean to say that, but it's the next hospital is quite a ways away. And so I've lived your life. I thank you for continuing it. I've moved on to bigger things, I guess, so thank you.
Okay, Representative Scrobber, will you please close on your bill?
Thank you. I think Kimber has done her due diligence working with all the departments, and I would look for a favorable vote so we can keep moving forward. Remember, there's like 1.5 million people come to Grand Marais every summer, every year, and there has to be a hospital. It's just the way it is. And this is one of the venues to get to that, to ensure it's going to be there. Kimber is a very high, I fear for the community when Kimber has to retire, because without her, that community would not have what it has. I'm serious. It's unbelievable what she does. She drives the ambulance. So mm-hmm. Representative Hewitt knows that. So, and okay. Representative Backer knows how that works. So, and she's the hospital administrator. Just does everything. So she has done due diligence to get to this point. And our role is to help her clear this hurdle. So I appreciate anything you can do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, thank you. And again, encourage the agency to work with this hospital nursing home. So Representative Scrobber, thank you. The chair lays over House File 102029 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Next on deck is House File 1105, Representative Agbajay. Welcome. While you were coming up here, welcome. Welcome to the committee. Representative Bierman, will you please move Representative Agbajay's bill for before the committee with the intent that the bill is laid over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1105.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Agbajay, before we get started, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman, would you please move adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the adoption of the A1, please.
Thank you. Representative Bierman moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Agbajay, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill. We're trying to keep this within 10 minutes. So I know it's important, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This should be relatively quick. I do have one testifier with me that I believe is on Zoom, but we'll get to that shortly. So thank you for hearing House File 1105. As amended, this is a bill that will require the Commissioner of Health to conduct maternal death studies based on the available funding. Unfortunately, the United States has one of the worst maternal mortality and also morbidity rates in the developed world. And that does show up here in Minnesota. We have disparities, and in the last set of data that was collected between 2017 and 2019, we saw that black mothers were 2.3 times and Native American mothers were about 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy than white women. And of many of those deaths, 40% were in rural Minnesota. So this is affecting every mother and birthing person in Minnesota. And so we need this data to better connect people to the care that they need before, during, and after pregnancy, to better care for pregnant people and to better prevent their deaths. If we are going to begin to eliminate or significantly reduce preventable maternal deaths in Minnesota, we need good and consistent data. And so by requiring the commissioner to collect this data in this report, we can better and more closely follow trends, find the patterns, and develop solutions to maternal mortality in Minnesota. And so with that, I'll turn to the one testifier and then open for questions.
Yes, we have the testifier, I believe, on Zoom. So please, testifier, Jennifer, please state your name, and we ask you to keep your testimony to about 2 minutes. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Becker and committee members. So my name is Jennifer Almanza. I'm a mother, a midwife, and an obstetric nurse leader for an integrated healthcare organization that delivers approximately 10% of the babies in our region. I serve in many roles, including as a legislative coordinator for our Minnesota affiliate for the Association of Women's Health and Obstetric Neonatal Nurses, or AWON. And I offer this testimony today for HF 1105 in collaboration with Dr. Cresta Jones, who's a maternal fetal medicine and addiction medicine physician and my co-chair on the State Maternal Mortality Review Committee, or MMRC. So Minnesota's maternal mortality review process has evolved significantly in the last 6 years. During this time, we've optimized our data repository and our reporting system. We have published the first two state maternal mortality review reports, and we're preparing to release our first five-year aggregate report in the coming month. Our committee has focused on creating high-quality case narratives through detailed abstraction and, more recently, through key informant and family interviews. This approach has allowed us to better understand the human, community, provider, system, and societal factors that have contributed to maternal deaths in Minnesota. Understanding these contributing factors has enabled us to make more relevant and comprehensive recommendations for improvement and prevention of maternal death. We've developed a robust interdisciplinary review processes that includes the equally weighted voices of high-risk perinatologists, medical examiners, therapists, social workers, doulas, nurses, and members of the most impacted communities. Developing this voice of the committee has been instrumental in understanding the multifactorial contributors to maternal deaths in our state. MMRCs are not the action implementation arm of maternal death prevention. Rather, we are the providers of the data. As a practicing quality improvement specialist in a large matrix healthcare system, I would not make sweeping recommendations in the absence of good data, and neither should we do so as a state. The data compiled by our MMRC committee grounds maternal health improvement recommendations for the state. Our committee members are active in carrying forward recommendations in their own capacities. And just as a quick highlight of some of the previous recommendations we've made, have been supporting Medicaid for postpartum mothers up to a year, which is a critical period where nearly 50% of maternal deaths occur. We have also been vocal in increasing access to medications for opioid use disorder and for mapping referrals across the state, which is something many of us have been involved in. So in sum, I'm deeply concerned that without the protection offered by this minor language change, that our state risks losing momentum in this vital work. I'm concerned because we've already seen some changes across MMRCs in the country. And if the MMRC is deemed as something optional versus as something mandatory to improve the health of our state, this committee could be jeopardized. The absence of a Minnesota MMRC would significantly set back our progress in understanding and making recommendations for maternal health improvement initiatives. Therefore, I urge this committee to make the recommended changes to HF 1105, changing the language from may to must. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Would anyone from the public like to testify? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. Members, I will open up for questions and discussion, if there's any. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Agbaje. It means so much to the community to have this this resource available and to pay attention to the experiences that people who are having children, especially, particularly Black women and others, are taken care of and looked out for, so that we can understand the disparities, we can address them, and so I'm really grateful to you for this work.
Thank you. And then Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje. Can you tell me, so currently does the Department of Health conduct these maternal death studies now? And if they haven't, is there a reason?
I'm sorry, Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair. So yes, they do conduct these studies, but they're on kind of a up and down cadence, right? It's not a set cadence. So the last set of data we have from 2021 or from 2019 was the last time they put out a report on maternal deaths. They are anticipating putting out another report that goes up to 2021. But what this language would do, and the Senate has also heard this as well, and they have a version where they would make it annual. And so we'll probably work with the Senate to get the clarification on the timeline, but it would make sure that there's a set timeline when they need to be doing these reports.
Okay. Follow up?
No, thank you.
No. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Agbajay, please close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate your time today. This is just a step in the direction to ensure that we have the correct information in front of us to be able to begin to tackle how pregnancy happens, occurs, and what happens during pregnancy to keep more birthing people safe. So this is one step. I imagine there'll be other bills addressing other steps as well. So I encourage support once this bill is laid over.
Well, thank you so much, Representative. Chair lays over House File 1105. As amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So members are a little ahead of schedule, so we will lengthen the time on House File 11 to roughly 25 minutes. So we have, House 1100. So next, House File 1100 from Representative Bonner. Again, I ask testifiers to keep their remarks to 2 minutes. We have more time. That way we have time for questions and discussion from our members. So, Representative Bonner, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1100 before the committee and recommend that it be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Now, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Could you please move adoption of the A1 author's amendment?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment, which makes a simple clarification to the bill, removing the word 12 and replacing it with 13.
Okay. Representative Barner moves to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Barner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and members, House File 1100 is a critical lifeline to Minnesota community pharmacies that form the backbone of critical patient care for our neighbors and for our communities. The current method of payment for dispensing medication is broken and unsustainable. Minnesota pharmacies across the state are in crisis. Between 2013 and 2023, Minnesota lost 61% of small independent pharmacies and 39% of chain pharmacies, meaning that one in five Minnesotans is now living in a potential pharmacy desert. So how do we get here? In short, the payment model used to cover the majority of prescriptions is broken. It fails to cover the cost of prescriptions plus the cost to dispense it. The most recent 2021 dispensing survey states that an average cost of $11.55, while PBMs and managed care contracts for MA patients reimburse at far below this dispensing medication fee. Frankly, it's simply unsustainable, and this is broken. The system is the primary driver of pharmacies' losses in our community across rural Minnesota and the urban core, and notable losses within the last year, including about 40 pharmacies just this year. Our local pharmacies and pharmacists are a critical part of the continuum of care, providing services like medication management, delivering flu and COVID shots, while pharmacists often know their patients better than their own doctor as they see them more often. These are the folks that know every sniffle, that know every asthma attack and every cream to put patients back on the road to health. Some local pharmacies, like St. Paul Drug, go to elaborate lengths to help patients get the medications they need and provide services to help our patients fill prescriptions they cannot. When doing so, would result in large losses, like $130 less than it costs to fill a prescription. They assist these patients at no cost to ensure that our elders and our families get every medication they need when filling it in-house, which would put their very existence at risk. This is, again, unsustainable. As these community resources disappear across Minnesota, they will not be coming back. A number of states like Minnesota have acknowledged the crisis and created similar programs to the bill before you to ensure their survival. States like Tennessee, Kentucky, New Mexico, and Ohio and Michigan, closer to home. While I wish that House File 1100 solved this crisis, it does represent a critical lifeline to ensure access to care to our neighbors and our communities when our families need it most. This bill has bipartisan support and a diverse group of geographic representation, as this issue defies community and political boundaries. I ask that you support House File 1100 and take this critical step. In your packets, you will notice a number of handouts, most notably a map of potential pharmacy deserts. I'm sorry it is not in color. It's a little more impressive in color. But it shows where these pharmacy deserts are transforming Minnesota with each passing day. And with that, we have several testifiers here today.
Thank you, Representative. First, we have Jessica Ostrup. You'll have to help me on that. Next, again, the next on deck will be Justin. Please state your name, Jessica, and 2 minutes. And we're going to keep you pretty tight to those 2 minutes on this, please. We have 5 testifiers, so thank you.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Jessica Astrup Arrett. I am. Thank you for having me. I'm not good at 2 minutes, so I'll do my best. My name, as I said, Jessica Astrup Arrett. I'm a pharmacist and third-generation owner of Astrup Companies. Sterling Pharmacy is the name of our business. We operate 12 community pharmacies in southern Minnesota, 4 long-term care pharmacies, as well as a specialty and infusion pharmacy that's in Mendota Heights. Sterling was founded by my grandpa in 1952. We grew our business to more than 20 retail community pharmacy locations and have slowly downsized our footprint to remain viable to our 13. Today we have 1 in Iowa. Many of our stores, like others, are at risk of closure. We just closed 1 in Faribault at the end of last year. Recently, as stated, Minnesota has seen some of the highest levels of closures in the country, and the stat about 1 in 5 Minnesotans living in a zip code without a pharmacy is about to grow because many independent community pharmacies serve entire counties. So, for example, in Houston County, in the corner of the state, we have the only pharmacies in the county. So if we can't keep our pharmacies open, there is not a single pharmacy in that county. And if you know that geography, it's not easy to get from one point to another down there. It's gravel roads and hills, and we provide a critical service down there. Pharmacy closures aren't only devastating rural Minnesota. We have increasing growing urban deserts due to various reasons, but still important that people don't have timely access to critical medications. I think it's important to give a couple human examples. We have a patient named Sharon who lives 12 miles from one of our stores, 17 miles from another pharmacy. She's legally blind and on an injectable medication. Our pharmacist, Michelle, drives to her house for every dose, draws up the dose, and watches her give the medication because, again, this medication could be lethal if she draws the wrong amount out of the vial. So by Michelle going there, maintaining that level of patient care, it keeps the patient living at home, saves costs to the system, keeps her out of the ED, keeps her alive. That's not going to happen without an independent pharmacy in that community. Another example, our Faribault pharmacy closed last year. Close to my heart, I started a program with a clinic for the uninsured in that town, Health Finders, if any of you are familiar. We had a really deep partnership. When we closed, those patients lost access to their cash payment model medication, free sliding scale medication access for chronic care.
Please wrap that up, please.
Okay, sounds good. And when our pharmacy went out of town, they tried other pharmacies in town. Patients' dignity was at stake, their care was at stake, and they're now driving 20 miles out of town to another one of our pharmacies to receive care. So it's not just deserts, it's hands-on patient care provided by independent pharmacies that is different. We need a lifeline. We need something quick. Right now we're seeing underwater reimbursements in the hundreds of dollars. One managed Medicaid plan, we're losing $100 on EpiPens. We can't buy an EpiPen at the one brand that the plan covers. We can't purchase at that price. So we're in crisis. We're on the verge of closure. We need something, and this bill will give us a lifeline, hopefully, until more permanent legislation can come into play. Thank you.
Justin, and then after Justin is Andrew Russell, and then after Andrew will be John. So, Justin, 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Stofron. I'm the anti-monopoly director for the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots general farm organization that's represented family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities since 1918. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1100 and want to thank Representative Bonner for bringing this bill forward, as well as you, Mr. Chair, for being a co-author, and as well as several other members on the committee. At our most recent annual convention in November, MFU members voted to make ensuring affordable and accessible care as a top priority for our organization, and specifically identified protecting independent pharmacies as key to meeting that goal. House File 1100 will advance that effort by providing a critical lifeline to struggling pharmacies across the state, serving our most at-risk communities, particularly small towns in rural Minnesota. This bill will help protect what we still have, but we also share the view that I think you'll hear from coming testifiers that the root of this problem is the anti-competitive conduct of pharmacy benefit managers. I'll just note that PBMs not only squeeze local pharmacies, but have also been found to play an important role in driving up the costs of prescription drugs. We urge this committee to support this legislation so pharmacies can fight another day, but also look forward to working with members on the more structural reforms needed to establish a fair playing field for pharmacies and protect affordability and access in rural communities. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Amanda Boo Boo, Andrew's next, but Hildy is after Andrew, then John. So if you, both of you, Andrew and Hildy, could come up. And Andrew, please state your name and 2 minutes, and thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Russell. I am a owner of Elko New Market Family Pharmacy in Elko New Market, a small independent pharmacy. I'm here today representing Minnesota Independent Pharmacists in support of House File 1100. Independent pharmacies are a crucial access point for healthcare in our communities, often, as in my case, the only healthcare entity. We are the first point of contact for patients seeking advice on medications, managing chronic conditions, and navigating the healthcare system. And frankly, we're in the middle of a crisis. And Minnesota pharmacies are at a breaking point. There's a handout in your packets here with some jarring charts. Looks like this. In Minnesota, 44% of all pharmacies, both chain and independent, have closed in the last 10 years. Of those pharmacies, 58% have been independent pharmacies. These pharmacies are closing everywhere. It's not just a rural issue. So they're closing in both urban and rural areas. There's a map in your sheet there showing zip codes without a single pharmacy. The Minnesota Department of Health estimates that more than one-third of residents in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the First Ring suburbs are living in pharmacy deserts. In a 2024 study, Minnesota ranked 10th in the nation for the largest proportion of residents living in a pharmacy desert. Nationally, last year, in 2024, 3,200 pharmacies closed, and at least 326 since December. The vast majority of these, 73%, have been independent pharmacies. The bill before you helps address what is widely regarded as the primary driver of pharmacy closures: unsustainable under-reimbursement by pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. In this case, by PBMs contracted to administer the MA outpatient drug program, which accounts for roughly 85% of all pharmacy enrollee coverage through MA. An add-on direct dispensing reimbursement to qualifying rural, underserved, or independently owned pharmacies will help preserve prescription access and improve health outcomes for all of our patients. There's a substantial need for community pharmacies throughout Minnesota. In fact, we've been approached by several city governments over the last few years asking if we can bring a pharmacy to their community. Unfortunately, each time the answer has had to be no.
If you can wrap that up, please.
Sure. To wrap up, patient access starts with an open pharmacy. Mm-hmm. Although this is not a long-term solution, this bill is a great first step towards that end until a more comprehensive PBM reform can be implemented to save Minnesota pharmacies. I urge you to support and pass this bill. It is a vital lifeline for our independent pharmacies and the patients we serve. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Hildy, and then after that, John. So go ahead and please keep your testimony to 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
State your name also.
Oh, okay.
And where you're from.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Hello, my name is Hildy Hessian, and I'm a nurse and the creative director at St. Paul Corner Drug in the Matt Groveland neighborhood, not too far from here. Linda, David, Miriam, Kyle, Suzanne, Eric, these are all names of patients that responded within hours when we asked for their stories in our pharmacy's most recent news bulletin. Because they care about our survival, a few of them fill at least one of their medications at a local chain like CVS or Walgreens because we'd otherwise lose money filling it for them. Eric doesn't even fill his prescriptions with us yet. He's been coming to us for vaccination since the COVID-19 pandemic and is anxiously awaiting being taken off our new patient wait list, which we implemented again last month for the second time in 3 years. Because in our industry, due to PBM abuse, more business isn't better. When we're already busy, more patients simply means more prescriptions filled below cost. The math just doesn't work. All of these patients' emails and texts to me told the same story with different specifics. Patients need high-quality, local pharmacy. I would bet that a good chunk of us in this room, myself included, take at least one prescription medication. For some, it simply makes us feel better or prevents long-term consequences. For others, like our patient Linda, who is a type 1 diabetic, having access to a local pharmacy is a matter of survival. But we do so much more than fill patients' prescriptions. We triage walk-ins, we check their blood pressure, we educate them on chronic disease management, we vaccinate them and help our communities reach herd immunity. And most of this we do without scheduling an appointment or billing an office visit. Pharmacy is essential healthcare, and having access to it locally is both a necessity and in peril due to PBM abuse. And once a local pharmacy like us closes, we won't be back until PBM reform is achieved. Our healthcare system won't be the same without us. I implore you, listen to independent pharmacists like Andrew and my father, John, who's speaking next. Hear and work to understand our story so that we can continue to provide excellent, life-altering health care to Minnesotan communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And then our final testifier that's did beforehand, John, we've had you here before. So please state your name, where you're from. I know this is important to you, but would ask you to keep it to 2 minutes, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Hessian. I am a pharmacist and the current owner of St. Paul Corner Drug, located at Snelling and St. Clair in St. Paul. We're an independent pharmacy, been serving the community for 103 years. I've been there almost 36 of those 103. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the other independent pharmacists in the state of Minnesota regarding the crisis for community pharmacy access. You've heard of issues from Andrew and Hildy. I'm not gonna reiterate some of this stuff again, but House File 1100 is one of several bills critical in the move towards fair reimbursement, ensuring pharmacies are paid adequately, reflecting the real expenses of safely dispensing medication, including staffing, equipment, compliance, patient counseling, and many more. Minnesota community pharmacies are essential to the health and vitality of our population. They are the first point of care for thousands of patients every day, providing life-saving medications and trusted advice. Without immediate legislative action, more pharmacies will close, leaving patients with fewer options, longer wait times, and reduced quality and access to care. House File 1100 is not just about fairness, it's about survival. Fair reimbursement will protect access to care and ensure independent pharmacies like mine remain open to serve patients who rely on them the most. So what does this mean, you know, with fair reimbursement? Or what are we talking about being underpaid? I brought the receipts, literally. I mean, this is a report of the prescriptions we filled at my pharmacy in 2024 that were below operational cost. And we define that as the cost of the medication, the actual pills in the bottle, plus the $11.55 dispensing fee. So there's 55 lines on a page, and there's 754 pages here, which totals a little over 41,400 claims. That's 65% of my prescription business. I just to give you kind of an idea of what this means. So the worst is on the top, and break even is the last page. So we have to get to there before we actually cover the cost of the pills in the bottle. Then we have to get this far down to have enough revenue to buy a candy bar. And then here is a bottle of soda. To have enough revenue to buy a bottle of soda, we have to fill that many prescriptions. There's 55 on a page. This is a typical cup of coffee at a coffee shop. And like I said, the very last page is where we break even, covering the cost of the medication and getting the $11.55. I mean, this can't continue. The math just doesn't work. And, you know, this has been eroding for 20 years at least. You know, it used to be that this report would be about 5% of our business. Then it went to 10, then to 20, and onward to where we are today. And for me, it's like 2/3 of the prescriptions I fill. And for some of my colleagues that I've talked to across the state in some rural areas that maybe don't have quite the volume of prescriptions that we have and maybe a different mix or maybe a different mix of plans that are paying them, there's as high as 75% below cost. So we know that, you know, there's something we can do about it and we need to do something about it. And, you know, pharmacy is going to keep closing until we get the math right. So our legislature plays a role in solving this issue, and we need to work together to pass meaningful, life-saving legislation this year.
Thank you. Would anyone from the public like to testify? Okay, I'll open up to questions, but before then, we haven't represented Franson, but before that, it is, I live in one of those deserts. My pharmacy closed about 4 to 5 years ago, and I'm a business owner, and it just boggles my mind that a vendor would not be concerned about their customers, and that's an independent pharmacy. How they have taken an approach to let these independent pharmacies control. I work with a lot of different business owners, and I do everything I can to make sure that they make a profit. And I am very challenged with the independent pharmacies and other pharmacies. We now have urban deserts in the metro area. These policies that we have done over the years have caused this, and we have to look at ways to reverse this. So with that, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions just because I know that Representative Bonner likes to ask a series of questions as well. No, I'm just kidding. This is a number one concern for my independent pharmacies too, and so based on your testimony today and the bill at hand, and of course some emails from my district, I requested to be added to your bill. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have, and members, we're going to go to about 10 after for questions. So we got time here. We got 11 minutes. So we appreciate everybody keeping things moving. I know this is an important. So we are next on Representative Purcell. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill. Thank you to the folks who came from my part of the world, especially Sterling folks. This was brought to my attention when I took this job at the legislature, because I used to use Sterling Drug in Northfield religiously, partially because of their amazing partnership with Health Finders that serves a lot of folks who don't have access to health care or health insurance. And with this gig, I no longer get to choose to support my local pharmacy. I have come to understand that that may actually be beneficial to them, that I'm not a patient. But the way that our system is currently set up feels like we're rewarding the wrong things. And I'm really grateful that you've been working on this, Representative Bonner. This is something I also enthusiastically support. There must be a better way. And I just really want to thank the testifiers and the author. And we've got a long way to go, but happy to support this as a Band-Aid. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Bonner, for carrying this. And I know you and I have both worked on these issues for a long time. And I mean, thank Mr. Hessian for his testimony. That was just, you know, oh my gosh, it really illustrates the problem, and he's done that before and again and again, and this is a really serious problem that needs to be fixed. I just really raised my hand to say that I have a different bill that addresses this, and I'm glad to hear my Republican colleagues really recognizing the problem, of course, because a lot of these pharmacies are in the rural districts that Republicans are representing, and obviously they're of great concern to everybody's constituents across the entire state for all the great reasons that have been expressed. This bill, I think it would be a Band-Aid, but it would be a very expensive Band-Aid. I note that there's it's going to need a fiscal note, of course. I assume we don't have that yet, but what your bill does is try to use the existing system, as one of your testifiers pointed out, to try to just put more money running through the MCOs, paying them more so they can pay their PBMs more, to tell the PBMs you must pass this money along to the pharmacy. We have such a convoluted system, and to have to do it that way, and who knows if the money actually gets from point A to point C, I don't know. But what my bill does, and actually the governor's budget does something very similar. It says let's use one point to pay for all of the prescriptions. Let's do this through DHS, through the fee-for-service system, which right now is doing better because we, in last 2 years ago, I think, actually said the state is going to raise our reimbursements to these pharmacies, and we did. We were paying that amount of money to dispense. That is their cost of dispensing. But unfortunately, as was said, only 15% or so of the claims run through that. If we could run them all through that, then we as a state could be in control and actually raise the reimbursement to what it needs to be to support these small pharmacists. And I really appreciate your bringing this. I think it's a great illustration of the problem. And I just hope that in the governor's budget, it saves a bunch of money to actually carve out the program and run it through DHS. And I think that's probably why the governor included it in his budget, because it finds us savings at a time when we need to find savings by actually doing things better. And so I really appreciate your bringing this, but I think we have actually a better solution on the table that will take care of this problem and save us money. Thank you.
Okay. Did you have Representative Franson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, Representative Bonner actually did come up with a question. I'm still on your bill, of course. But can you just explain to us, like, we're coming into a $6 billion deficit, and we did have an enormous surplus previously in 2 years, and, we didn't have much of a say during the last 2 years, and I'm just wondering why this wasn't brought forward or something done when we actually had the finances, possible finances, to address this issue at hand. And you may not have the answer, and I'm not attacking you. Don't think of it as an attack. Yeah. I'm just, kind of curious here.
Yeah.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Franzen. I will say this bill actually isn't new. It was introduced in a previous session as well. And, like many things, we talk about what our priorities are and what we have on the table. The one thing we know is we will never, ever have enough money to fill every need in the state. I mean, that's just realistically, that's never going to happen. I know this bill was out there last session. It was something that was under consideration. It did not make the list. And again, I hesitate just because, we have... It's always a question, do we prioritize, say, paying for long-term care facilities or folks with disabilities or education? It's always a competing factor. This one did not rise to that level last time around. I think since that time, we've seen some increases in losses, and it continues to be that way. And I fully acknowledged in my presentation and today that this is a Band-Aid, right? This is not... going to solve the crisis by any means, and there are other proposals out there that may do a better job of actually solving the crisis going forward. But it might also, you know, and I don't know what our financial budget situation will look like this year. I do know that this is potentially a option, and maybe it's a yes and. You know, it might be we need to do something short term to help those pharmacies stay alive while we implement a more long-term solution. I can't say. I'm hopeful that by laying this over today that we have it on the table and we have the ability to potentially prioritize it and assess it among other proposals to see what we can do. But I think we are at a critical place where if we don't do something, we are going to continue to lose pharmacies at an alarming rate. And as you pointed out, you know, there's several in your community. Within this last year, we lost the pharmacy in Nisswa, where my family is from. You know, and I can't tell you how many times I was in that pharmacy and talked to the pharmacist. And, you know, this is the guy who literally knew my grandfather like the back of his hand, right? Like he knew everything about him. He knew where he lived. He knew what he was on. He knew what he did for a living. He knew all the people in the community he had helped. I mean, these pharmacists in these small local pharmacies, they're not just a pharmacist, right? They know your community. And that's why I said earlier, they know your asthma medication. They know your cream. They know everything about you since you've been this high, you know? And when those resources are gone, they're not coming back. And so I think we are at a place where we really need to be talking about this conversation.
Okay, members, seeing no further questions, Representative Barner, please close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In closing, I just want to say, you know, I acknowledge this is not the solution, but it is a critical lifeline for Minnesota community pharmacies that form the backbone for critical patient care for our neighbors and for our communities. Without intervention, these community resources will cease to exist at a time when community resources and human connections are needed most to put our neighbors back on the road to health. I want to thank all of those who've expressed support for this lifeline to ensure their survival. And again, this bill is not new, but the situation continues to evolve and devolve. And really, I think the important part about this bill is that it defies political ideology and political or geographical boundaries. And so I hope that we can find a solution both short and long term to ensure our pharmacies. And with that, I would renew my motion to ask that House File 1100 be laid over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barner. The chair lays over House File 1100 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. As amended, folks. Okay, next is House File 2057. We have a co-presenter. We have Vice Chair Nadeau. We have Lee Bierman. So, and again, I ask testifiers to keep their remarks to about 2 minutes. Excuse me. The chair moves the bill before the committee with the chair's intent to lay over the bill over for possible inclusion or in the omnibus bill or further action at a later date. So, Representative Vice Chair Nadeau and Lead Bierman, to your guys' bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I will be leading off here for the committee and presenting today with the author, Representative Nadeau. I'm pleased to be before you today and to be co-authoring House File 2057, which I believe will be a good start in helping stabilize medical assistance funding for Minnesota's hospitals and accomplishing this without relying on state dollars. This bill establishes a directed payments program to benefit the entire hospital community across the state. It does this by putting an assessment on Minnesota's hospitals in order to draw down additional federal Medicaid dollars. These federal dollars are a critical step in stabilizing medical assistance funding for Minnesota hospitals. I do want to note that this is a complicated bill, and the language is likely to have some changes as we get more input from DHS. I also want to share that the Minnesota Hospital Association has been working with Health Management and Associates, one of the premier national healthcare consulting companies, which has worked with CMS and healthcare providers around the country in constructing and implementing directed payment programs. Directed payment programs are not new. They are not shell games. They are a tried and tested way for states to leverage more money into underfunded Medicaid providers. For context, CMS has approved 249 distinct directed payment programs in 40 different states. This bill, again, establishes a directed payment program to benefit the entire hospital community across our state. Minnesota's nonprofit hospitals provide care to everyone, regardless of income or insurance status. Yet the financial foundation of our healthcare system is at a breaking point. 40% of Minnesota's hospitals and health systems had a negative operating margin last year. Even those hospitals that were fortunate enough to have a positive margin are still experiencing challenges with rising labor and supply costs and flat reimbursement rates. The medical assistance program is paying on average 68 cents on a dollar of cost to provide inpatient hospital care, and that's based on 2019 costs. It was estimated that last year, our Minnesota hospitals and their related health system services collectively were underpaid by over $1 billion when providing services for medical assistance enrollees. We need to do something now, or I believe we will see more and more service line closures and access to care across our state erode. When services are lost or cut back, it impacts everyone, not just those on our government health programs. This directed payment program is a solution that we need to pass this session. Now Representative Nadeau will lead and provide additional comments about the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bierman, and thank you for working with me on this bill and all of the partners that have been working on this. Directed payments members provide a mechanism for states to supplement standard Medicaid payments and shrink current Medicaid payment gaps. The gap in Minnesota is growing as payer mixes shift and result in significant impacts on hospital operating margins, patient access, and on our broader healthcare system. Given the number of limited resources and the required state share portion needed to leverage additional federal funds, Minnesota hospitals, like many other hospital associations across the country, have identified an assessment mechanism that will meet the CMS guidelines, standards for being both broad-based and fair. CMS has rules for both the assessments and the disbursements, and the model of this bill meets both of those tests. I want to be very clear. This assessment is on hospitals and not on any other healthcare providers. In addition, this assessment will not raise prices in health to healthcare consumers or to the health plans. The bill language is structured in a way that the assessments and the disbursements are done on a quarterly basis with timelines that assure minimal lag time between the two, allowing hospitals to manage their cash flow challenges. Simply put, on average, for every 40 cents the hospital community puts in, they will receive 60 cents in additional federal dollars up to the allowable federal cap. By implementing the directed payment program as designed, Minnesota can capture an additional $1 billion in federal Medicaid funding to stabilize our health care system and preserve access to care. This will be just like 40 other states are doing now with their own directed payment programs. We all know that many of the Medicaid programs and funding streams are being looked at for potential cost savings at the federal level. Meanwhile, other states are claiming these federal dollars, and Minnesota is bearing the consequences of not having done this sooner in a broad way. We need to pass this bill to get in the queue for CMS approval and recognize that future program adoptions may be possible and necessary. I know we've said it, but these directed payment programs are in place around the country in both red and blue states, and Minnesota should join this list. This is a bipartisan solution that strengthens our nonprofit hospitals and health systems and preserves access to care. And I'm going to walk through the bill quickly. In the bill, on the first section, section one of the bill creates a new state assessment on hospitals' net inpatient and outpatient revenue. Payments are due quarterly, 30 days after receiving an invoice from DHS. Paragraph G addresses new hospitals, merged hospitals, or closed hospitals. Paragraph H identifies the procedures for underpaid or overpaid assessments. Paragraph I limits any use of the revenue to only non-federal share of the new directed payments program. Paragraph J suspends the collection of the assessment when federal matching dollars are unavailable for any reason or if the directed payment program is not approved. Paragraph K discounts, it provides for discounts and exemptions as necessary to satisfy federal law. Paragraph I requires DHS to uniformly reduce the assessment required if the allowed federal match share increases. Paragraph M requires DHS to consult annually, create kind of a work group with Minnesota Hospital Association on the documentation and methodology of the assessment. Section two creates the amendments and interaction with the Hennepin County Medical Center's current law, where they already have a directed payment program that Representative Liebling was vital in creating, I think, in 2021. Section three governs the mechanics of the new directed payments program. Subdivision 1 are definitions. Subdivision 2 identifies the requirements for federal approval. Subdivision 3 establishes the commissioner's duties. Subdivision 4 starts looking at the establishing the health plan duties for payment methodology. Health plans must allow hospitals to review their own claims for validation, procedures for hospitals to identify discrepancies and dispute claims with DHS. Subdivision 5 requires health plans to make payments to hospitals. Subdivision 6 identifies the requirements for hospitals receiving payments, and it prohibits hospitals from negotiating with managed care organizations regarding the directed payment amounts or passing those assessments on to patients, or violating any DHS standards. Subdivision 7 establishes state policy goals for Medicaid related to the directed payment program, and it requires DHS to coordinate with the Minnesota Hospital Association on measures for access to care and state policy goals. Subdivision 8 provides an annual review of the directed payment program by a select committee. And Section 4 establishes the Hospital Directed Payment Program dedicated fund and requires DHS reporting on that fund. Section 5 is just session law requirements. As Representative Bierman said, it's a complicated bill. It's going to come back before this committee. There will be amendments to this bill. We're going to hear some concerns and we're going to hear some testimony coming up, and I'm happy to now, I have two hospital CEOs, one rural, one urban, that are here today to provide some comments, as well as staff from the Minnesota Hospital Association, if there are any technical questions. And so at that time, I'd like to ask testifiers to come up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Doe. We're going to Chelsea first. Okay, we're doing Chelsea. Ms. Olson, please state your name. And then after Chelsea will be Rick Buemer, and then Trevor after that.
Okay.
Yep, we're cool.
Okay.
We have it handled there, Representative Dole. Okay.
My table, Mr. Chair.
It's my room. Okay. No. No. Whoa. I got the bigger horse. Okay. No. Go ahead, Ms. Olson.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans and our nonprofit members share the concerns over low MA reimbursement levels and the impact that this has on providers and patient access. Low MA rates also impact commercial rates, which are well above the cost of care to offset the loss from MA rates. We appreciate that this funding mechanism used in this bill does not create a new tax that will add to new costs on commercial premium payers. Instead, this program uses existing funds to leverage federal money to increase MA rates for hospitals, which has the potential to help alleviate the existing cost shift on commercial rates. We appreciate the intent of House File 2057 and are supportive of the concept. As organizations tasked with administering the flow of $1 billion each year, we do have a few changes we would like to see to lessen the potential administrative burdens. This includes the MCO payment timelines in the bill. We would request that these align with the industry standard of 30 days. Note that 30 days would be the maximum amount of time that MCOs would have to make these payments. Our members pledge to turn around these payments as quickly as possible, but the 5 days in the bills is just too short. We also have concerns with the financial penalties imposed on plans for delays, which may be outside of our control. Line 7.14 in the bill already includes a prohibition against MCOs unnecessarily delaying a directed payment to a hospital. Lastly, we request clarifying language to be added to the bill to ensure that that the program ends if federal funding concludes. We appreciate our discussions with the proponents and the authors who have been receptive to our requested changes, and we look forward to continuing to work with them on this concept in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Rick, you're next, Trevor, and then Joe. Please state your name, where you're from, and about 2 minutes, please. Okay. Thank you so much.
Chair Backer, committee members, I'm Rick Brewer. I'm CEO at Community Memorial Hospital in Cloquet, a rural independent critical access hospital in northeastern Minnesota. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak today. I've worked in healthcare for 35 years, with the last 25 of those being at Community Memorial. So I've seen a lot in those years. I've seen the disruption of Y2K. I've seen the worries and struggles of the recession of 08, 09. Of course, the extreme challenges that we all faced during the COVID pandemic. I am here today to tell you that the strains and struggles and challenges that we're seeing now are unprecedented. The operational strains are worse than anything that we faced during COVID or any other time. A major factor driving this stress on hospitals across the state is Medicaid payments falling farther and farther behind the cost of care. As this has become a sizable portion of the mix of people that we serve, we simply can't continue to absorb or cost shift our problems away. Every hospital has a story to share. Many of us are struggling. I know for us, our financial situation has significantly deteriorated in the last 5 years. We have had to close service lines. We have to talk about what other service lines we will have to close. So this is not hyperbole. This is not crying wolf. This is very real. To keep the doors open in the communities we serve, we are going to have to narrow and limit what we offer to those communities. And representing rural in a rural community, the hospital's not just the hospital. We also often have the clinic, home care, hospice, EMS, so many other services. And when you start pulling at that ball of yarn, the whole thing can start unraveling. And stress on that system stresses access across the system. One of the most challenging service lines in rural Minnesota is labor and delivery. I would argue that for a rural hospital, there is no service line that loses as much money per patient served as labor and delivery. And a lot of that has to do with who's paying the bill. Because while for a rural hospital, maybe 15 to 20% of our patients are on Medicaid, probably for labor and delivery, half of the moms and babies born or more are covered by Medicaid. And so you can't cost shift away from that. Medicaid funding then has a disproportionate outsized role in ensuring access to this vital service. And we all know that the closer to home a mom can be for prenatal care and for delivering a baby, all else being equal, the better outcomes are going to be for mom and baby. This directed payment program can stabilize Medicaid funding with no outlay from the state, and it will ensure this vital access is protected for underserved communities, especially for moms, babies, and everyone living across rural and indeed the entire state of Minnesota. Chair Backer, committee members, I really appreciate your time and consideration of this vital legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We have Trevor and then Joe who are signed up. Please state your name, where you're from, and again,
thank you.
Approximately 2 minutes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Backers, members of the committee, co-authors. My name is Trevor Swalish. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for North Memorial Health. This truly is an urgent issue, and I appreciate the time and attention on this important bill. For nearly 70 years, North has been more than a healthcare provider. We're part of our communities, and we have proudly said yes to anybody who needs us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, regardless of where they are from, or what they need, or their ability to pay. And we stand firm in that commitment to be there for our patients always. It's a kind of a promise that we hold very, very dear to who we are as an organization. As a quick overview, as many of you know, North Memorial has two hospitals, one level one trauma center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, and our Maple Grove Hospital, which is a leader in delivery of babies every year with over 5,500 births. We have 25 clinics, 45 specialties, and provide over 340,000 clinic visits a year. We also have one of the largest air and ground ambulance systems in the state with over 110,000 transports. We have 9 helicopters, and we provide over 3,500 air transports in the state. The totality of that is we are a critical piece of healthcare infrastructure for the entirety of the state and the region. We also are an employer of over 6,600 people that have dedicated their careers to serving the people of our communities and of Minnesota. We need help now. All of that is at risk. Our mission and the care we provide is truly at stake with this bill. We serve about 75% of our patients at our Robbinsdale campus are on Medicare or Medicaid. The totality of losses we have in underpayments for those two programs is about $187 million a year. We are not asking for all of that to be made up, but we do need help. Our ability to actually manage that amount of loss is at its end. Those underpayments are putting healthcare and healthcare infrastructure in Minnesota at risk, not just for North Memorial, but for the entirety of the state. If North Memorial were to fail or to close services, it would put pressure on all the other health systems. If any of the rural facilities were to close, it would put more pressure on us. This is a very significant problem for the whole of the infrastructure. As our co-authors covered very well, this is a program that has proven itself in 40 other states. We are looking to assess ourselves as the funding source for this, so we're not putting additional burden on for state funding. But what is important, as we heard, is how quickly we can turn it around. The way we can afford to do this program is to have a very tight turnaround to the monies that we provide, to the monies that we get back from the federal government. Clearly, there's some question as to what the federal government is going to do with Medicare and Medicaid. While we believe that there could be some challenges to that, the fact that this is a program that is in 40 states, both red and blue states, and is a critical part of how healthcare works in this country, we do believe that there is a good chance that it's going to be sustained, and we need to get ourselves in the queue and considered to be part of this important program. Without this, we are going to have to close locations, we are going to have to eliminate services, and there is no ambiguity and there's no crying wolf about that. If it does not happen this year, those will be critical choices that we're going to face, amongst others, and maybe even more dramatic choices that we're going to have to make as a system. So, Representative Nadeau, Representative Bierman, thank you for your work on this. Chair Backer, thank you for hearing the testimony. This truly is important for us right now, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And then Joe is next and final as a signed up ahead of time. So go ahead, please, state your name. And just like everybody else, try to keep it within 2 minutes.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Joe Schindler, Vice President of Finance with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I'm here to provide just a little bit of an overview of the mechanism itself. The Directed Payment Program represents a public-private partnership to help solve an issue that's been festering for years. Nonprofit hospitals and health systems have been stressed for more than a decade. Chronic Medicaid underfunding has been an ongoing concern, especially with Medicaid enrollments increasing significantly since the pandemic. Currently, the Medicaid fee-for-service payment rates for inpatient care are 68% of costs, 2019 costs, that is. So, and there is no indexing of those costs up to the current time period, so to 2025. So we're missing a good 6 years' worth of inflationary adjustments, even at 68% of the cost. So MHA has been working with Health Management Associates, a national consulting firm, over the last couple of a year and a half to develop this directed payments program, which is a model that is similar to, as was mentioned, 40 other states have implemented since 2017, when CMS defined that the upper payment limit for Medicaid managed care is the average commercial payment rate. This program is designed to, on the average commercial payment rate, our model is actually modeled that we will only reach about two-thirds of that commercial rate because of the size of our program. It's smaller. This program is designed to provide clear transparency to the legislature, the Department of Human Services, Medicaid managed care organizations, and hospitals to ensure the integrity of the Medicaid funds flow. As you know, the Medicaid program is funded with a combination of both state and federal funds. Minnesota's Medicaid blended match rate is roughly 40% state share, 60% federal funds, as was mentioned earlier. Our managed care Medicaid directed payment program proposes to have hospitals provide the state share funding through a quarterly assessment, followed quickly by DHS's work to claim the federal matching dollars and to distribute those Medicaid payments back through the managed care Medicaid managed care plans to hospitals within a reasonable 30-day time period. And it's important to us because hospitals are in critical condition with regard to finances. So we can't afford, if we're gonna fund this out of cash flow, we can't afford to have those funds held up anywhere along the line. None of the costs of this program will be passed along to health plans or consumers. Now, while this may sound like a complicated process, it really is not. All of the data necessary to support the program is already housed within the Department of Human Services. And both MHA and our consultant HMA stand ready to support DHS with technical assistance to annually calibrate the directed payment program model to meet federal requirements. Secondly, MHA is also ready to support DHS with any implementation or operational aspects necessary to meet the logistics of the program. So with that, I stand ready to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Members, we have about 12 minutes for questions. And we have Representative Hewitt first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo and call out North Memorial for their continued dedication to the service in Minnesota. They are a humongous safety net, especially in the trauma area. And I think that's so important that we recognize that as a committee, that if they went away, it would be a huge hole blown in inside of our trauma care and other services they provide. But what I want to ask the authors, or maybe even the individual from North, with ambulance-based services, are they able to take advantage of this? You know, I have a bill that takes care of ambulances, but I'm wondering if one of these services is, if one of the hospitals own an ambulance service, that they can take advantage of this also.
Joe,
okay. Mr. Chair and committee, this program is specifically designed to address inpatient and outpatient hospital side of the equation. I will say, though, that directed payment programs can be designed specifically for EMS as well, so that is something that is being considered separately.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we're going to have to continue with my bill then, too.
Okay. Thank you for the advertisement. We are now next on Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, So to the authors, I get the problem, and obviously I did carry a bill that HCMC is using to help sustain its mission, and you know, clearly the problem is a serious one. I do have a number of questions about this program, though, and I have read the bill very carefully. So I'm just going to say up front, some of my questions probably should be offline and to the advocates behind this because they're more technical. But I do want to ask a couple of kind of big questions, and it's probably going to be your testifier from the Hospital Association who's going to hopefully be able to answer them. But in the bill, my first question is there, can any of the funds, either the fees on the hospitals or the money that's being returned to the hospitals, be used for any other purpose? In other words, are there any other hands out in here? Either the Hospital Association itself is getting anything, or health management associates, who you said help do this program. They usually work on a contingent fee basis, I understand. So I'm particularly concerned about that. And because members, if they work on a contingent fee basis, that means they get some percentage of the money that flows through this. That would be really concerning to me. So that is my first question. Does any of the money in the bill go anywhere other than through these other entities to the hospitals?
Go ahead, whoever wants to take that question.
Yeah, do you want to?
Well, I'm just going to say no, but I'm going to hand it over to Joe.
Mr. Chair and committee, Representative Nadeau is exactly correct. There are no other sticky fingers in the mix here. And by the way, HMA, for our, the work they're doing for us is on a time and materials basis. There's no contingency or anything like that. They're providing all the technical assistance involved with developing the program because they have experience in other states. And actually, they're the organization that Department of Human Services recommended to us to be able to use. So, and MHA doesn't have any funding with in this program either.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that is good to hear. I will want to know kind of how they're being paid then on time and materials. I assume the Hospital Association is, and you're nodding your head. That's great. There is a line, though, in the bill that I am a little concerned about. I'd like to know what it means, and it's on line 5.2, and it's, or the part I'm concerned about is on line 5.2, so it starts, this sentence starts on 4.31, so the commissioner must determine the quarterly payment amount using the average commercial payer rate or using another method, acceptable, et cetera, if the average commercial payment is not approved, minus the amount necessary for the plan to satisfy assessment liabilities under, and it mentions a couple sections of law, attributable to the directed payment program. So apparently there's some portion that is being carved out here, and maybe this could be offline if this is really technical, but that language gives me pause what exactly that is. And then I do have one other issue after that.
Okay, whoever wants to answer that question, please go.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee, so the average commercial payment rate is the absolute upper payment limit. We just want to make sure that we're under that. As I mentioned earlier, the program that have sized today and will be the size of the program is approximately only two-thirds of that amount. So we are well below what that upper payment limit would be. This just contemplates if the commissioner had to make adjustments to the program, but we're so far from the cap, it wouldn't even come into play.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you could, you know, don't want to monopolize this if other people have been reading this bill and have questions, but it's a pretty technical bill. And I, like I say, I'm not going to ask every single question I have here, but one other one that I do want to ask here in committee is on page line 7.31, there's a line that says the directed payments must be used to maintain quality and access to a full range of healthcare delivery mechanisms for medical assistance enrollees. And that term delivery mechanisms, I'm not really sure what that is, if that's defined anywhere. I'd just like to understand what the meaning of that is. I think it's good that in the bill it's saying, you know, this money is for hospitals to use for the purposes of our program, which is great. But I just wonder what that line means.
And just reminding members that this most likely will not be the last time we hear this bill, because there's going to be some changes, but we wanted to get this out. So if you could answer that question, and then I'm going to go to another person that's on, another representative on the list after this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee members, really that language is meant to say that we are maintaining access to care. By putting in these payments, we're able to maintain access to care. We also, through an amendment, will probably be adding some language around some quality goals, especially around maternal health and things like that. So those are coming yet, but that's the intent.
Okay. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question about Section 3, Subdivision 4. So it's the bottom of page 6, top of page 7. And I'm just curious if you could help me understand your vision, your intent with the oversight of the claims.
Please. Whoever wants to take that question.
Mr. Chair and committee members, really what we're trying to do is create some transparency in the process, and hospitals will need to know what is the basis for how they're going to get paid based on the managed care claims data. So we are hoping to get better transparency to hospitals to be able to see what data was pushed through the system so they can validate, yep, that those were the number of claims that were for UCare and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota and so forth. And so the count is accurate, therefore the directed payment should be accurate.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. Is there any precedent for like a third party or an independent person to look through these kinds of claims, or has it traditionally been just hospitals looking at their own claims and then looking at the MCO's claims?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee, there could be a third party, but I don't think that's been the precedent. We've been working with HMA on this program. They, of course, have administered many of these programs across the states, and I haven't heard of anything like that third party validation. Could be done, but that would be an extra cost in the system. So,
okay, thank you. So, seeing no further discussion, Representative Bierman, Representative Nadeau, you have about 3 minutes, so please close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing the bill. There's, as stated, a lot of good questions came out today, and there will be many more, and we'll bring this bill back. And just on that last point of Rep. Hemmingson Yeager, I just want to say we do have DHS in the mix here as far as oversight as well. So thanks for hearing the bill, and we look forward to moving this forward.
Representative Dole.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for working with this. This bill is going to take everybody working together to get it through. There's a lot of people that are working on trying to tighten this language up. And I appreciate the questions. I appreciate the conversation and look forward to seeing this again. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and the chair would agree with our two co-authors there that this is a very important bill for our hospitals and our medical services here in Minnesota. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2057 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or further action at a later date. Thank you, members. So seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing is Monday, May 17th, and members, we are adjourned. Thank you.